Thanks, Chris. I'd just add to that on the regulatory piece that the other thing we observed, that this is actually quite unusual for such an old accounting standard. So it's quite common in the first couple of years of introduction of an accounting standard that there'd be a lot of debate between preparers, regulators, auditors, and then users reading the financials as to what does that really mean, how have you applied it. It's certainly less common amongst accounting standards that 20-odd years later we're still having those same debates. And the other thing that we observed is that the impairment standard was written in a largely amortisation-only world. So it wasn't introduced to replace extensive existing impairment requirements. It was essentially the first attempt at creating an impairment standard, and with 20-odd years of experience behind us, we think it's probably now the case that we have enough body of evidence as to how this works and how it doesn't to really re-examine those requirements and how they apply in practice. The other thing that we noted is that there are some very specific requirements in IAS 36 that you could fix. So one really good example of that is this thing about the pre-tax discount rate. So I think every year, you know, we say to the valuations people, please kindly give us a pre-tax discount rate, and they roll their eyes at us and say, well, you can't really derive a discount rate in a tax-free vacuum, so here's your post-tax discount rate, and you auditors and accounting nerds, you may go away and do with that as you will. And so what people tend to do in practice is either they just use that post-tax rate in their models, or that's what they do, and then as a final kind of academic exercise at the end, they reverse engineer a pre-tax rate for the purposes of disclosure in the financial statements. So it'll be very easy to say, well, the ISB can solve that. We can make a limited scope amendment. We can change those words and say post-tax rather than pre-tax, and there's the job done. But that's not actually where the debate then lies, right? Because everyone does that first piece of the exercise that I've just described. That's, I think, established principle, even though it's not what IAS 36 says. That's what happens. And that's not where the debate with the regulator lies. It rather lies in, okay, now having done that, I will then have to use post-tax cash flows or it won't match up. So now how do I work out what tax rate should apply to those cash flows? How do I take into account if I've got unrecognised tax losses that I expect to give me a tax-free shield on those cash flows, how will I take that into account? If I use the reversal of existing balance sheet amounts in calculating my tax cash flows, how then do I factor in my tax balances into the carrying amount of the CGU, taking into account that tax balances are not discounted, but the cash flows I've just derived now are? So a limited scope amendment that says, aha, I see the problem, I will change the word pre-tax to post-tax, of course, won't actually resolve the genuine areas of debate that occur in practice. Another area that, the way our outreach worked is we spoke to a number of analysts and preparers, our major audit firms and regulators, obviously also wanted to have their 2 cents worth, but the larger number of contributors were from the preparer and the analyst community. And one of the things that was terribly badly understood, I think, is what this concept of a cash-generating unit actually means and how it links to what management do in practice. And the overwhelming feedback from preparers was, well, you're essentially asking me to do this exercise that has no bearing on how I manage my business. So, for instance, if you think of a supermarket here in central London with very high central London rent, it's very likely to have negative cash flows. They're independent negative cash flows because it does generate its own cash flows, but very highly likely to be negative. And the reason that the supermarket chain would not say, ah, that's a loss-making supermarket, I'll close it down, is that they know if every day when I just need one thing on my way home from work, I pop into a particular brand of supermarket, the chances are that when I do my big shop at a suburban supermarket at the weekend, I'll choose the brand that I'm familiar with, right? So when a supermarket chain is considering how do I manage my business, they are not looking either at just that supermarket right here in central London is loss-making, I must shut it down, nor are they looking at, well, my whole supermarket chain across the UK is profit making. Therefore, the central London one must be okay because the man in Edinburgh buying his groceries bought a sandwich there during the week. Obviously, that's not the case either. So we also note that more recent accounting standards that have been written, for example, a AASB 8, focus a lot more on how do you actually manage your business. You tell us your story. We're not going to dictate to you exactly what that story must look like. And we think if the cash generating unit definition were brought more into line with that, that may actually help with some of the resistance we get from users around how do we define our cash generating units, where at the moment the only linkage between the two is that ceiling in IS 36 that says, well, once you're combining your CGUs for goodwill testing purposes, you must not go higher than a segment. That's the only way it actually links truly well into how the business is managed. Another area of debate was around the difference between fair value less cost of disposal and value in use. Now, all of the analysts that we spoke to said the difference between the two is utterly lost on them. So if they read in the financial statements the sentence saying which model has been used, it has no meaning to them whatsoever. Their interpretation was that either way you're doing a discounted cash flow model, which is usually true in practice. What tends to happen is that we see people try to do a value in use model, see what comes out of that, and then they might push for fair value less cost of disposal for no other reason than that the restrictions on future restructurings and growth and that sort of thing cannot be taken into account in the value in use model. Then what happens is we say, value in use hasn't got me the answer I wanted, so now I'm going to try fair value less cost of disposal. And for those purposes, I can then argue that, well, any market participant would have my growth plans or they would have my restructuring plans, and therefore I can muck about with my discounted cash flow model until I get to the answer I want, usually being no impairment. And we think that's not particularly helpful in practice. We think it creates a lot of debate around, well, then what would a market participant really take into account and whose crystal ball is better than the other person's crystal ball. And it steps a little bit away from, that management really being able to say, well, this is my budget, this is my plan, and then we can look at, well, how good are you at making plans and budgets to form a view around that. But if they are just allowed to say, well, anyone in the market would do this, that's what I would like to do, it makes it very hard for auditors and regulators to decide, well, how do I accept that? And we believe that actually if you took the value in use model and rewrote some of those restrictions to certainly have some limitations on them, but perhaps be more open to, well, if there is a good plan in place and we can see it happening and perhaps it's, there's good solid evidence behind it, that those could be brought into account in that model, leaving the fair value less cost of disposal model only for those assets that are genuinely to be disposed. Again, linking back in then to what management actually plan to do. I have this CGU, I plan to dispose it. It makes sense that the way I would value it would be fair value less cost of disposal. Disclosures were discussed in a great degree of detail. It's fair to say that the analyst community were of the view that, well, we'll take any information that you'll give us. So thank you very much. Anything you suggest, we'll take it. However, there was a number of reservations around commercial sensitivities and also around sensitivity models and what those truly mean. So if you flex only one item in a model to prove that, to say, well, if I change my discount rate by X amount, then I will have an impairment, but that's actually not hugely meaningful unless it's a fully dynamic model, because if my discount rate changes by a certain percentage, other things in the model will also be changing. There will be cash flows or whatever that are triggering that change in discount rates. These things don't happen in isolation. So our view is that if you change or add disclosures, that is the last piece of the puzzle. It's not actually going to resolve the ongoing regulatory debate, and that although more disclosure is always good as far as the analysts are concerned, more disclosure absent actually revisiting the way in which the underlying information is calculated is possibly not going to be particularly helpful. So having considered all of the feedback received and the well-documented global regulatory concerns around how impairment testing is working in practice, the Australian Board believes that the ISB should give consideration to reopening IS 36 in its entirety for issuance as a new standard that addresses the issues that we've raised in our paper, but also any other issues that may come to the Board through their own outreach processes. I would love to hear any comments.
Thank you. Alberto.
We are not convinced that the IS 36 standard is fundamentally broken, so we would not recommend to reopen in its entirety. This standard is a principle-based standard, and like any principle-based standard, is open to judgment, requires judgment, and this one more than others because it's looking forward to what the future of the of a company could be in the next 3-5 years and so on. But and this is where the problem comes. I mean, because of the judgment involved, the management is always over-optimistic. I've seen in 40 years of this profession many, many business plans. I've never seen a business plan not being like this, you know, in the future. But this is not a problem with the standard. It's a problem with how it is applied and how it's challenged by the auditors and others. Having said this, probably some fine-tuning is needed. For instance, this question of the post-tax rate, pre-tax rate, I mean, they all use pre-tax rate to do this calculation because it's done by professional evaluators normally, and they always use post-tax rate. Therefore, I mean, it would be just to certify what's happening in practice and doesn't change too much, the results. We are not convinced about allowing future restructuring and future enhancement of assets because, again, it would add other judgments, other, not only judgment, but I would say expectations which may or may not materialize. I mean, a board of directors could say 3 years from now I would do some sort of revamping of the of my asset, but after 3 years maybe there's not the same board, there's not the same managing director and whatever. I mean, so it's adding, again, a room for maneuvering. Cheesy definition, yes. There might be room for better guidance, better restrictions, by the way, because, again, what we saw is very, very large, very, very large cash generating units. Because by enlarging the cash generating union, by claiming that the business is all interconnected, I mean, business going bad is matched with business going good, and so there is no problem of impairment of goodwill. Some disclosure on the subsequent success of a business acquisition, yes. This could be something useful for the user. The user would like to have that. So, I mean, again, this is an area where some better guidance can be given. Bearing in mind that after a few years, it's very difficult to really identify how the acquired business 5 years ago, for instance, has gone because it's so integrated. And this is it. I mean, need for complete revision of IS 36 and some fine-tuning and some better disclosures. That's our position.
Thank you. I read your report and the presentation with great interest, and I think it is a really interesting idea. And I have one question about your CGU issues. And actually, you are saying that CGU is somehow artificial. We should align with the management concept. So somehow you are going to introduce some management approach into the deciding CGU. So take an example of supermarket. If you acquired the supermarket in this center of the London, the acquisition in itself could be a failure because the cash flow is not as expected. So it's somehow loss-making. But if you look at the effect of the acquisition in total operation of the London area or wider UK area, then it may create incremental value. So therefore, you cannot say that this acquisition was not successful. So actually, it is true. But my question is, do you think we should focus on the acquired business only, or you just focus on the ongoing business in general? I mean, because the IS 36 is impairment test for the acquired business or acquired PPE. So then whether, and also the users are very much interested in the whether or not the acquisition in itself was success or failure. So then if you go to your proposal, you are just looking at just ongoing basis. So how do you explain the purpose of the IS 36 is to know whether the acquisition was successful or not?
Certainly. I think, and that goes to a recommendation that I didn't touch on in my presentation, which is that actually there's a lot of confusion about what the purpose of IS 36 is.
Yeah.
So does it actually ask you to verify how well a past acquisition has gone, or is it just trying to test what's on the balance sheet? And that is one of the reasons we have so much debate, is it's actually quite hard if you can't go back to first principles and say, well, this is what we're trying to do here. It's very hard to make that call. One of the comments that was most common when we spoke to analysts is once you have put a number of entities together, it's very hard, as they said, to unscramble the egg. So although you might be 1 year in able to assess the London supermarket on its own, 2 or 3 or 4 years in, that ability to assess that individual acquisition on its own is problematic. Now, of course, if that individual acquisition meets the definition of an operating segment itself, then you will on an ongoing basis and also through impairment testing under the existing standard even be able to do that. But the reality is that most business acquisitions aren't done as an independent bolt-on. I would like an operating segment that does X. They are more done as I'm buying this because it will integrate into my existing business. And so before a couple of years is up, it's usually not possible to assess that acquisition on its own.
I see. So then using the example of eggs, I'm not eating fried egg, but I'm eating scrambled eggs. So I don't care whether the shape of the egg is beautiful or not.
Yep.
Thank you.
So I think what we're saying is we would say you need to divorce the two issues. And if you want to look and follow through on the acquisition, that's not the impairment testing.
Okay, that is not the purpose of the impairment testing. Impairment testing is to see whether or not in general operation, ongoing business in total, whether or not acquisition add incremental value or not.
Yes.
Right. Okay. You?
I just have some very quick comments on this paper. Generally, we agree that we agree with the simplification of the impairment approach. The first point I would like to emphasize is the goodwill impairment. Although this paper is broader than that, as we discussed in the past several SF meetings, that the goodwill impairment is really a hot topic, especially in China. I won't repeat that again. But the reality is, as the standard setter, we are under, very a big pressure in this issue. A lot of people are questioning or even criticizing the goodwill impairment accounting treatment in Chinese capital market. That's the first. The other thing is that I would like to share a case. I just saw this the news on the website last weekend that the security regulator just punished a listed company and its auditors. The main reason is that the company used used the post-tax discount rate in the value in use calculation. So it got punished. Some people are saying it's not fair because it's very difficult to get the pre-tax discount rate. So personally, I think that an improved, simplified approach should be encouraged, and should be we should do something in this area. That's it.
Alexandra?
Two comments here. I completely agree with Alberto when say that IS 36 is a pretty principle basis standard, very to the point. But I think this complexity that we're discussing here is that's the main reason why people in major jurisdiction is strongly favoring getting amortization back. Because at the end of the day, it's so complicated, so subjective. This definition of cash generating unit can vary so significantly. People honestly analyzing the situation and can get reach so different answers that when you add some bias to that, then you can get it pretty much anything. So it's a pretty good standard, but maybe it's too ambitious. You know what I mean, I think don't think that we in practice, or accountants in practice, or corporate governance in practice, are prepared to do this. But this is a point that came out. But to be more constructive here, I'm talking about paragraph 49 on page 17. In the discussion that. The market can predict impairment made before. And there is some anecdotal evidence as well as academic research that shows that impairments bring new information to market. So the recent events of Kraft Heinz and GE in the US are good examples of that. So when they disclose impairment, the stock price collapsed by more than 10%. So it's really very, maybe the market could be seen as an additional input in the impairment test, but not the view that the market can predict all impairments. So to add a threshold, for example, if I have an investment in a company which is listed and the price to book is lower than one, that's a pretty good signal that maybe my investment is overvalued. So instead of using the wording, I use market analysts as an additional threshold to discuss impairment, I think.
Anthony, thank you. The one recommendation you didn't talk about, to
as much you said, which is obviously about clarifying the purpose, and I think everything else falls from that. When we discussed this at IFAS, I first sort of disagreed with the notion of reviewing IS 36 in its entirety, but it seems what you mean is, let's just not concentrate on goodwill, look more broadly, and in that instance, I think that's right. But so we can get confusing notions of what the purpose is when we start talking about business accommodation, we start talking about the IFRS 3 project. But I actually think more recent steps of the ISB have reiterated and reclarified. So what do I think? I think the purpose of impairment test is about the recoverable, is about ensuring the recoverable amount of individual assets is not overstated. It isn't about looking at the business as a whole. It isn't looking at the total value of the business. I think the purpose is actually quite clear that that's what it's intended to do. All the concerns about shielding, where they've been raised in IFRS 3, is because we have looked at too much of an aggregated and portion of the business. When if we disaggregate, we're going to get more meaningful information. We know there is this growing gap between market value and the net asset values in the book. So there's bound, if you go high enough, you're always going to get shielding. You're always going to fail to recognise impairments. I think the focus has got to be the other way on that. It's about individual assets and their recoverable amount. And if you can't identify cash flows in those, we need to open it up to a cash-generating unit. What we do with goodwill when we group CGUs together is something else. That's back to the business combination part. But if we're looking at this, I think that's what we're trying to do. So yes, there are difficulties which can be refined, but I don't think that is really about changing the purpose. It's just ensuring the current purpose is properly implemented. Now, the issues that you've identified are the potential improvements. I think these are ones which the ISB are currently considering anyway, but certainly we've considered them and EFRAG has considered them in its work. And I think they are all valid recommendations that need to be refined and examined. Personally, I do think we should consider removing the restrictions on future restructuring. But then it's getting the right conditions to ensure we don't get a free for all, which I think is your point about it. But you know, we're always faced this trade off between reliability and relevance. And it seems to me it may be easier to ignore them, and we can put a stamp on that and say that's easier to. But it's not particularly relevant if we know something is going to be developed, and that is the value we expect to generate. And also, I said there's already so many judgments that go into the future forecast without bringing restructuring in, almost to say that's a forecast too far, when we can say predictions about what we think growth will be and how we will be a better business without enhancing the assets. I think it's a rather grey line between the two anyway, so I certainly do think we should examine that. That might remove the need for a second measurement base in practice. Because as others have said, often people go to fair value, so they can factor in the restructuring. So that might follow. And I entirely agree with your point about post-tax discount rate. It is not a matter of just changing the reference rate. The real issue is around what tax cash flows do we either include in a post-tax calculation, or we accommodate in the adjustment back to a pre-tax rate. It's the same problem. It's what are the tax cash flows? And I think if this was going to genuinely lead to more consistent and less costly impairment, which is another one of the objectives of the ISB, well, we would have to come up with some simplifying assumptions about how you deal with tax. But that would thereby have a feedback on what exactly was the measurement base we were trying to achieve. There has to be some interaction with that measurement base and how we deal with tax. Finally, on the point about changing the CGU definition, I don't think, if you go back to where I started on the objective, that I think it's about being as disaggregated as possible. I don't think the definition should be changed. Whilst things like flagship stores are interesting anomalies, I don't think you necessarily fall on the side of saying you definitely should include a wider group of stores. because then you don't know about the operation of that flagship. So effectively what you say, it's like a loss leader. We don't avoid the losses on loss leader products just because we know we're going to sell other more profitable ones. And similarly, I think it isn't necessarily the case that the investment you've made in the brand through that should be recognised. We wouldn't always recognise it in other ways. It's kind of effectively the loss is developing the intangible asset, but there isn't enough evidence there to justify the value. So all I'm saying is there's two ways of looking at that, and I don't think it necessarily says we should look wider.
Chiara.
Well, the comments we are getting would not support a rewriting IFRS 37 in its entirety, and we don't share the need to clarify the purpose of the impairment testing. EFRAG issued two discussion papers and feedback from constituents at that point in time showed that many didn't agree with the single approach, and most respondents did agree to amend the value in use calculation for the post-tax discount rate and in order to include the cash flows from future restructuring. Now, on the other points, messages from the consultative forum of standard setters, the thinking was that the implementation is not straightforward. But then views were a bit split whether additional guidance would be welcome or not. Some would welcome additional guidance on valuation aspects, such as the terminal value or the identification of the cash generating units and its allocation and the goodwill allocation to the CGUs, while others are concerned that additional guidance would restrict the use of judgment. And finally, some members call for amortization of goodwill to be reintroduced.
The easy solution. Peter.
Thanks. It's a very interesting paper. I'd like to comment on three aspects of it. First of all, I was interested in your comments saying that people sometimes seem to be almost abusing the fair value less cost of disposal part of the model to play with the assumptions a bit. In the outreach we did with auditors, we got two different types of reactions. From some auditors, we got the reaction that they found the assumptions in value in use much harder to push back against than the assumptions that were used in fair value less cost of disposal. And the reaction we got from the others was that they were largely indifferent between the two, and they had about as much or as little difficulty in both cases. Whereas you seem to be picking up almost the opposite conclusion, that people might find it harder to push back on the market participant assumptions than the entity specific. So that was sort of an interesting piece of feedback for me, because it wasn't totally consistent with the feedback we've had. My second comment is about your comments on the CGU, which you said you thought was a rather artificial notion, which I don't totally follow that really, and sort of in line a bit with Anthony's comments. And the starting point in IAS 36 is that if the asset generates cash flows all by itself, then you test it all by itself. If it only generates cash flows with a bunch of other assets, then all you can really do is test it together. So it seems to me that that's actually quite a natural kind of concept. Of course, it can be a bit difficult to apply in practice in some respects. But it doesn't seem to me that's any more artificial than the idea of how does the management operate the business. I don't know that's necessarily any less artificial, really. Of course, there's likely to be some overlap, because if they're generating cash flows together, they're going to be managed together. That's obvious. My third point is something you touch on in paragraph 52 is switching options, and that's where you're saying that's something that's considered in fair value less cost of disposal and not considered in value in use. And I think that's probably right because of the way the value and use guidance is written, because it's so anchored on the budgets, which I think almost by definition are looking just at a single outcome, whereas clearly market participants would be looking at a range of outcomes and would be looking at any inherent flexibility to change a perspective. And I think that's an interesting area to pursue, because one way of looking at value and use is it's just an entity-specific version of fair values using entirely market participant assumptions where they're available. And value and use, you could argue, is using either all or perhaps some entity specific, but in a way you might expect it to include the same kind of ingredients. It's just different assumptions about what they are. And then your proposal to switch to a model that says use a value in use unless you're expecting to dispose in the short term or committed to or something like that, that really seems to negate the idea of picking up the switching options. And in some cases, those kind of switching options or options to start or stop could be quite a significant component of the value.
So I think just picking up on that second point about the CGUs and artificial constructs, et cetera, I think it comes back again, and this is part of the reason why we think it is useful to open up the whole thing and be really clear about what it is that you're actually trying to address. So even if you are trying to look at individual assets, that's actually not how these assets are being used. These assets are not being used as individuals, because if they were, then you would be saying they're all surplus assets and it should all be highest and best use, and that's actually not what the standards say. So for me, I think it actually makes a lot more sense if you did come back to one methodology, which is you're using these assets for their intended purpose. And if you're doing that, then it makes more sense to be looking at how you as management is actually looking at what's generating that particular income, and you're not looking specifically at an individual asset. So I think it's all tied into actually going back and having a real think about, well, what is it we're actually trying to do here? And that's what we're trying to get across, is that this is a very old standard, and it was set in a stage where we hadn't had any concepts of fair value at that time. And so it was really just putting a toe in the water. And again, if you know, you as management are saying, I think the best use of these assets is as a group together and it's existing use, then that's what you should be held accountable for. So you shouldn't be able to just run off and say, okay, well, there's another higher value over here, which is fair value, if I did something else, because that's not what you're telling the marketplace that you're actually going to do with those assets.
But then, in a way, the ability to switch to another use is an important part of the value as well, and that would obviously be something that a market participant would consider paying for. And I don't know why the entity itself wouldn't also consider that alternative value.
It doesn't appear to be, and I think, again, as you said, there's a continuum. So the preference we would have is that if, you know, you're genuinely intending to sell the thing, then it's fair value less cost to sell. If you're not intending to sell it, use your value in use. That seems to be a fairly reasonable assumption. If you're not going to go that far, we would still say one methodology, but if you're going to keep fair value and value in use, then be explicit about what the assumption changes actually can be and where it's coming from. And for me, it would be more where your reference point is, not that you can or can't do things under those different methodologies. And it is kind of interesting because I sort of listened to this debate, and on the one hand it's going, well, actually, no, IS36 is working okay, it's fine, but, oh, by the way, we'll tweak this bit and tweak this that bit. And really, when you step back and look at it, it does seem to me that there is some fairly fundamental things that we do need to think about with 36. And that if you just tweak little bits here and there, you're not going to get that overall cohesive picture. And that's the problem that people are actually facing in trying to implement this standard, is that it doesn't always make sense when you're trying to fit the pieces together.
I think, too, on that specific fair value, less cost of disposal versus VIU issue, there are a number of listed companies that, for whatever reason, are operating a business in a way where, frankly, you could sell the land and probably make a lot more money. We did discuss that at our outreach workshops, and the analysts that we spoke to indicated that they would only take into account that excess value, so the land value or whatever else your other option might be, if they could see a catalyst for that actually being unlocked in the immediate future. If you're going to... So the example that was bandied about in the workshops was... If you run a chicken farm in Sydney, but you've always run a chicken farm, you've got a patriarch who says, well, this is what I've done till the day I die, and I've just listed some of the entity off. The reality is the investors are not going to get the land value from having all that land in Sydney until such time as that patriarch has probably handed over the reins. So the view of the analysts was that it is only relevant to think about what other market participants would do completely differently if there's actually some kind of catalyst in sight for that to actually occur.
Raymond.
Just on that point, could I argue then that while if the catalyst, whatever the catalyst is that we're waiting to happen, if it, I may say to you, look, it's going to happen this year or in the next couple of years, and if it never happens, then we're back to where we started, aren't we? Can I use that sort of information to then determine whether or not I should be recognising an impairment charge? I think just a point to add on to that. I think that what I was going to say is I think from where we're sitting, it's a principles-based standard, and I think to the extent that we're applying the principles, we should be able to get the right answer. Whether or not people are doing the right thing is a different issue, and whether or not people are then using the words and the standards to their own advantage, rightly or wrongly, I think that's another issue that we need to consider. But I think there are certain things that need to be fixed that will hopefully get us to a point where the standard is applied more appropriately. Things like the definition of the CGU, I think that certainly needs to be looked at. Whether it's a post-tax or pre-tax discount rate, that needs to be to be looked at as well. But I think what we need to do, I think in putting whatever words are put together, we need to stick with the principle that is, or we need to stick with the position that maintains this as a principles-based standard. And in maintaining a principles-based standard, whether we then go with the standard model or we go with more than one model, I think we would not have too many concerns with that. The only concern would be, are we getting to the right outcome? And we're not giving too much of leeway to enable people to then misuse the words that we've got. That would be my concern.
I think it's quite an interesting issue because what I'd also like to see is, I think if you kind of simplify and relax the model, I think some of the consequence for that is that there's better disclosure and tighter disclosure. And what was particularly interesting for me was in the first round of feedback, the feedback from the investors was that they thought information about why you chose particular assumptions was also quite important. So, for example, your growth rate, was that a benchmark, an external benchmark, or was that something that was based on historical practice or history, etc.? But that didn't come out in the second round of disclosures, which I thought was quite interesting. And for me, I think some of that could be a bit of a trade-off, that you get this simplification, but by the way, we're going to actually ask you for some extra disclosure so that that compensates in case there is this shielding piece because you've moved up the CGU levels. So that'd be how I'd be looking at it.
Okay, final round. Cédric?
Thank you, Hans. Well, I agree with what I've been saying till now, that the standard is principles-based and the principles have not proved to be wrong, so there may be some difficulties in application. And maybe just one situation that has been mentioned is the lack of flexibility to change the CGU is one case that may lead to merge CGU instead of redefining them and transfer value from one CGU to another. Since business model in the sales have evolved very quickly in certain industries, and it has been difficult to reassess and reallocate the cash flows from one CGU to the others. And I think it may be one area in the standards that is not very clear and easy to deal with. That may lead to merge to too big CGU and lead to that shielding effect. And finally, on the post-tax rate, I agree that there is a real issue with the cash flows or the tax cash flows that have to be reassessed in order to make sure that they are not used for the impairment testing to shield the effect, an effect that would have not been recognized applying IS-12 only.
Linda?
Yeah, just a couple of brief comments. I mean, I generally agree, in particular with where Alberto started in terms of the standard, but I'm mostly thinking about this standard in terms of application in my previous life. And so most of the things that you're pointing out, there, I personally believe there's nothing prohibiting you dealing with those issues and properly applying this standard. Mm-hmm. I think they're mostly application issues. And so my experience has been that if you want to do a quality implementation or application of this standard, there's nothing prohibiting you from doing that. And I've sat around this table now for a while, and I've heard about the notion of the fair value less cost to sell versus the value in use, and how the value in use, the entity can do whatever the hell they want, when in reality, the way I thought about it was you couldn't separate the considerations between those two. And if you did make a different assumption, one versus the other, you had to rationalize it in terms of why it was appropriate in the circumstances. So I just don't think it's entirely broken. But I do think there are probably true application issues. I get that, and in my jurisdiction as well. And so I think the role in this case of the standard setter is to fix the annoying things like the post or pre-tax discount rate. If that's just adding noise to the thing, fix that. But you could also give some awareness to this is what the standard is intended to do, and maybe you can do things like this is best practice, or you know, doing some examples of what's really a good application of it, because I don't think it's entirely broken.
Jeho.
Okay. We are most interested in the recommendation on at what level of aggregation should the test be performed. So my comment is actually related to what Linda said before. So before making my comments, let me remind us of principle in IS 36. According to paragraph 80 of IS 36, when a company determines the cash generating unit to which goodwill is allocated, it should consider two criteria. One is the unit should represent the lowest level within the entity at which the goodwill is monitored for internal measurement purposes. Mm-hmm. And the other one is that the unit should not be larger than an operating segment as defined by paragraph 5 of IFRS 8 operating segments. So in this sense, I find that this report makes a striking observation in paragraph 74, saying that the guidance is so ambiguous and difficult to apply that entities may default to the segment level to avoid the specific requirement to properly determine the level at which goodwill is monitored. So I take this observation as meaning that companies tend to ignore the first criterion, mm-hmm, and then only stick to the second criterion, even though they are actually monitoring the goodwill at the lower level than the operating segment. So I'm very suspicious that this tendency would be the culprit of the problem that the goodwill is recognized too little, too late. So I strongly believe that this aspect should be more closely examined. Right. Thank you.
Noble?
Yes, thank you. We agree with Alberto and Linda in the sense that we don't think IS 36 is fundamentally broken. We think if IS 36 were to be revisited, we think we need to have a look at amortization and depreciation in general, and we are concerned that the project will be a very broad scope and will never get done. So,
yeah, there you go.
Okay, Nami.
Okay, thank you. For the AOSSD, I have received several comments from AOSSD working group members, and I do not repeat comments from Korea and Japan, yet another member mentioned that stakeholders in its jurisdiction raised issues with impairment testing, particularly on goodwill. So this member further noted that it would be difficult to consider the accounting for goodwill without fully appreciating its composition and without undertaking further analysis of goodwill. So this member noted that many of the concerns about the impairment testing of goodwill had caused because the current impairment approach failed to address the fact that purchased goodwill was diminished over time and was often replaced by internally generated goodwill. So accordingly, this member supported the ISB revisiting the possibility of an amortization with the impairment model and assessing whether that model could more faithfully represent the fact that purchase goodwill diminishes over time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Very good discussion. Let's take a break till 11 o'clock.